This is Linda DeMellis at CompensationStandards.com. I'm speaking today with David Koenig, the founding partner of Ductilability, a private research and advisory network serving boards and senior executives. David, how does the work you've written regarding risk and pay tie into today's environment?
Sure. Thanks, Linda, for having me. The focus of attention from the Fed and international regulators, and even in last week, President Obama, on compensation, I think in large part comes from what we've seen out of the subprime crisis. It's the first time that the magnitude of how incentives and compensation can change behaviors and have some negative influences and negative impacts. It's the first time that's getting this kind of attention, and probably because of the massive scale of losses that we've seen. There's a paper and presentation that was done by Till Sherman, who's with the New York Fed, which I think does a nice job of encapsulating a number of these issues, particularly as they relate to the subprime crisis. And he refers to them as the seven deadly frictions of the subprime crisis. And as an example for how incentives played a role in creating things that weren't necessarily desired by the people who were paying these folks, and we just have to look at the process through which a loan was originated and where it eventually wound up with the investor. The loan originators in this process were paid to close loans. So their incentive was to generate volume. They didn't necessarily care about the quality of the loans that they were generating. They just cared about the number. Standing between their getting paid and the origination that they did were the underwriter and the appraiser. So the underwriter within a company typically isn't compensated based on the number of loans that the company closes, but they might feel some pressure for efficiency, and they're certainly going to feel a good deal of pressure from the loan originators if they're putting up too many blocks to them realizing the commission that they would earn on a closed loan. The appraiser is in a similar position. The appraiser makes their money based on the number of appraisals they can do, and they'd like to have business referred to them by the companies, and the companies want to close more loans. So they're likely to use an appraiser that's a little bit more favorable towards finding values in homes that will allow a loan to qualify for the type of program that they're looking to put it into. Then we get to the companies that are securitizing these loans and the brokers that are ultimately selling them out to the investing public. And every step in the way, what we find is that people are incented to do volume and not necessarily to do quality. The investors, and then in many cases banks and other institutions that originated these loans, were left holding what are the bad pieces of these particular loans, and they're the ones then that have the risk that's being realized. So what we've seen in this case is that the people being paid to create the risks were given a different incentive than the companies who were holding on to the risks wanted them to have. And that's why I think it's come to the forefront. So what we're trying to do in an incentive structure is for pay and performance to be aligning rewards with risks. And that's why I think we're getting so much attention to this matter in the subprime crisis.
That's interesting, David. How might a compensation incentive system with objective performance metrics actually lead to a misalignment between an employee's incentives and the company's operational objectives?
Well, I think the key word that you mentioned there is objective. What you have in most compensation systems, particularly incentive systems, is something that's called a criterial control system. It's based on certain criteria or metrics. As I mentioned with the loan originator, it's the volume of loans that they close. And I think what people have failed to appreciate is the role that psychology plays in compensation. How does it affect people's behavior based on how they're paid? There's a Princeton psychologist named John Darley who coined something called Darley's Law, which in effect says that the more one uses these criterial control systems or metric-based systems, the more pressure there will be to corrupt the individual or a group as they try to meet the kinds of behaviors that these programs seem to be telling them to follow. He would call these systems that are not morally neutral. And what he means by that in a couple of different situations that arise is that consider a system where a person's hoping to get ahead. Most people are that way in their jobs. But what they see is that someone else is cheating on this performance system. Well, if the performance system doesn't catch them at their cheating, the other individuals wind up seeing their chances for promotion fade away. And so they have this perverse incentive to start cheating on the system too so that they don't fall behind. Another case may be where these systems are set up so rigidly in their metrics that a person who's a good person does what this system is telling them to do according to their own pay, optimizing their own pay, but it might be that the system was structured in such a way that it's incenting them to do things differently than what the company ultimately wants them to be doing. They don't really have an incentive to look towards the long-run objectives of the particular compensation package. What they have is the incentive to maximize their own wealth. Now, then we get into the case where people learn that a system is based on certain numbers, and they try to find ways to cheat the system and game the system. This allows them then to take their activities to a place below detection and to get away with something, maybe for a long time, maybe for a short time, get away with something that isn't in the company's best interest but does pay them the most that they would be paid according to these systems. So there are these three factors that we have to take into account when a system is particularly focused on metrics and not so much on the subjective as opposed to the objective. Finally, we want to consider what's called the role of authority influence. And this is important because what we're looking at is the difference between how an individual might behave within an organization and what their morals outside of the organization might tell them is wrong or right to do. Within an organization, and this is a company or any hierarchical structure, people take the messages that come from their, quote, superiors, their bosses, or the people who are in authority of a company, to have a greater weight. So when they see their boss doing something that they might consider to be unethical and being rewarded for it, they see that as the company or the organization saying that kind of behavior is okay. And we can look at places like Enron, we can look at Kidder Peabody, in the case of Joseph Jett from many years back, where we see these kinds of authority influence messages along with the kinds of incentive systems that are based on metrics in place and driving behaviors that the companies wouldn't want and certainly the shareholders wouldn't want to see. What, again, we want to do is to align the incentives with the risk that's being taken. And in particular, what we want to do in an organization is to change our compensation structures so that we're incenting behavior that is like the behavior we want out of an individual, whether we want that individual to act like a risk-taking entrepreneur, whether we want that individual to behave like an owner who has some vested interest in seeing the company survive for a long time, or whether it's somebody who's just supposed to be paid for doing their process effectively and well. What we need to make sure is that our systems are designed both subjectively and objectively to get the desired behavior. And objective systems tend only to incent behavior that tries to maximize the income for the individual.
How about corporate codes of ethics? Are they effective in preventing risky behavior?
Virtually every company has a code of ethics, and the code of ethics is a good thing. The processes and controls around a code of ethics are good things, but often there's an over-reliance that people understand what those codes are or even have read them. A good rule of thumb is that at every point of communication, roughly 20% of the value of a message is lost. So start with a code of conduct that comes from the board of directors. 20% of the information that the board intended to be relayed to the CEO is lost, either due to message compression or misunderstanding of the intent. Take that down to the senior executive level, to the mid-manager level, and ultimately when you get out to the people who are in the field generating sales, you may have lost 60 to 70% of the message from that code of conduct. Now, if people think that the regular employees have paid attention to this code, they tend to drop their guard and assume that everyone understands what the company really wants them to do from a moral standpoint. So you don't get the same kind of influence from that type of a code as you might expect. And then the big question is, what are you paying people to do? It doesn't matter what your code says if you're paying them to do something else. You can have all the best policies in the world sitting in one corner of the room, but if the compensation package pays somebody to be in the other corner of the room, you can guess which corner they're going to be standing in.
So what then is the risk manager's dilemma?
Well, risk managers play an increasing role, or should be playing an increasing role, in compensation setting within corporations. Risk managers tend to look at the world in the way in which I've described. What is the future like? Are we aligning the risks with the rewards that we've got? But risk managers also, since they have this unique knowledge, can become brokers of information. And what we know is when somebody has information and they're a broker of that information, they tend to charge for that information. If a risk manager's incentives aren't aligned properly so that they're compensated for ensuring that the corporation is both pursuing its objectives correctly and doing so within its stated morals, then the risk manager might feel the same kind of pressures that the loan underwriter or the appraiser felt. They might feel that they have to toe the company line in order to get their bonus payment if it's paid by the wrong person. You can get around this by having risk manager compensation set independently of what the business units do. And then I'll also give you an example of a dilemma that risk managers face, and this goes back to something that Darley had talked about in one of his papers, and it's called paving the rivers. Russian generals were paid by their Russian army soldiers were paid by their generals to show that their technology was very much up to Western standards and superior to Western standards. One of the demonstrations that they did once was to show how deftly their tanks could cross rivers. Well, what the generals didn't realize is that the people who had been showing them how deftly the tanks worked had paved underneath the rivers and just covered the pavers with enough water so that when the tanks came through, they made large splashes and looked like they were crossing the rivers with ease. What this meant is that the generals thought they were better prepared for war than they really were. Risk managers could potentially be given incentives and feel pressure to make the company's risk profile look better than it really does, unless their incentive compensation is structured the right way.
Well, thanks, David. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you so much, Linda.